Ladies and gentlemen, this is Red Ice Radio. I'm Henrik Palmgren from Sweden, Scandinavia, once the land of the Goths. Now, unfortunately, just another country stuck under the big, fat, ugly thumb of the new Roman Empire, the European Union. But everything is not lost, of course. We are still here, continuing to talk, continuing to try to wake people up. So thank you for tuning in. As you might know, if you've been with us for some time, we do kind of, well, I would call it open-ended investigations into many of the topics that we find to be of great importance. We hope that these discussions will aid you in your ability to navigate the dark and murky waters of the information age. We certainly do not agree with everything that we discuss. I hope no one does, but many of the topics intrigue us. Many of the guests we do, of course, enjoy, and we want to help to spread their work further. But some programs we record, we do simply for the benefit of investigating the claims, to be able to see if the theories hold water or not. I think that anyone who isn't already set in their ways, have a rigid belief system, and one who doesn't want to learn something new, including learning that you don't agree with a theory, will value our particular approach. So, you know, be skeptical and keep questioning, but be willing to listen to new ideas as well. We cannot know what we don't know, and we have to be allowed to listen, ask the questions, and investigate it in our own capacity, right? Well, whether you agree or not, today we have an important topic that we are going to discuss from a somewhat new perspective, or in a new wrapper, we might say. Our guest is Tjerd Andringa. He is an associate professor of sensory cognition at the Alice Institute at the University of Groningen in the Netherlands. Our focus today is bureaucracy from the perspective of cognitive engineering or cognitive science and how it applies to conspiracies and geopolitics. Tjerd sent me one of his papers on bureaucracy not too long ago that provides an in-depth analysis of bureaucracy as a psychological phenomenon, basically why some people want it. The paper lists key features and indicators of encroaching government administration and those rule-based iron cages that we all love so much. Later in the program, we are going to get further into how this applies to authoritarians versus libertarians, the difference in approach, and how one of these will always favor bureaucracy for purposes of control. Well, we have a very interesting program ahead of us, so stick with us, everybody, even if you don't get everything at once or can connect all the dots right away. So give us some of your attention and some patience, and I think you'll be able to learn some new stuff today along the way. Welcome, Tjerd. Thank you for coming on the program with us. It's really a pleasure to have you with us, so thank you for being here.
It's my pleasure.
You bet. Now, you sent me some interesting documents after actually a program we did here not too long ago, and you had some fascinating material both on bureaucracy, but also some of the kind of bigger connections in terms of what you call cognitive geopolitical theory. There's a lot of interesting stuff to your work, but before we get into the main body of that, why don't you just tell us a little bit about what you've been involved in when it comes to your involvement at the University of Groningen in the Netherlands, Tjerd?
Well, actually, it's the only university, basically, that I worked at. I studied physics there, solid state physics, but I did also did a lot of student politics. I was a student member of the board of the faculty at some point in time, and that gave me lots of insights in the education, because as a student, I was responsible for education. So I was asked to start at some point to help to start the what is now the AI department, and that was in 91 or something like that. And in the beginning, we only had education to do, and we loved developing the program and working with the students and so. But of course, at the university, you have to do research, and the university didn't allow us to do our own research. So at a certain moment, I did some illegal research, you could say, mainly signal processing. And then I started with that research a company. So I spent some time at a company called Sound Intelligence. Still exists. I'm not involved in it in any way. And we developed automatic listening devices that particularly listened to verbal aggression. And that is actually a little bit on the edge of what we would like to do in our society, yeah? Listening into people. So I started thinking about the consequences of basically the things that I was developing. And at a certain moment, I realized that I was not happy, that every time, it was after 9/11, every time the insecurity of our world raised, it was very good for my profits. So basically, I decided to stop that type of activity and to return back to the university. I became director of education of our programs and developed more and more research. And all my research, it's still aimed at sound, but now in how to create an optimal sonic living environment or an optimal perceptual environment where people can really make the most of their lives. And it is not intruding in any way, it's only helping. So that is typically what I do during the day, research and educating students.
Interesting. Now, artificial intelligence is one part of this, cognitive engineering, cognitive science. Maybe we can talk about some of those terms for people who don't know. AI, I think most people understand what it is, but is it the regular artificial intelligence that we are, you know, that we see in the movie world that you work with, or how would we define it, Jared?
I think the things that we do is typically we study natural intelligence and we prove that we know how it works by making something that does more or less the same. Yeah, so for us, the artificial part is basically modeling in real hardware things that we have learned from natural intelligence.
And this is slated to be adopted onto robotics and such? Or
yeah, typically, yes. Yeah. In my case, I have quite a big project in which we listen in a very coarse way to the sounds of a town, and we want to determine whether the sonic quality is good and where it can be improved, if some measures are actually working and improving the sonic quality, things like that.
And what is cognitive engineering or cognitive science overall?
Cognitive science is the science of our thought processes in general. So psychology is very much about people and how people interact with the world and how they have problems, etc. And cognitive science is a very interdisciplinary venture aimed at trying to understand what our brain is doing, what our mind is doing. So it's not necessarily aimed at the brain, but it's more aimed at the things that we do in order to remain alive, how we represent the world, how we perceive things like that, and generally in a more formal way than psychology does.
Interesting. Now, how does these interests and this work that you've been doing connect to the paper that you sent me on bureaucracy? What's the tie here?
Well, actually, at a certain moment I realized that on the one hand I was I'm part of a European network of people who study cognitive systems, and so cognitive science implemented into systems. And basically that we had no idea of how to make a robot that actually understands what it is doing. And I was thinking about that idea, and at a certain moment things at our faculty happened, and then I thought, well, bureaucrats actually also don't understand what they are doing. And then all of a sudden I had a direct link between bureaucracy and the difficulty of our field in making something that actually understands what it is doing. So it was kind of natural and by chance.
It's an interesting tie for sure. Now, tell us a little bit more then about some of the content in your paper and how you go about approaching the problem of bureaucracy. And we can certainly break this down into authoritarianism versus libertarianism and everything else. So, like, I'll lead us into the topic a little bit, Jared.
Okay. Well, let me see. At my university, it's a regular university. It's not particular bureaucratic. I think that holds for many of our environments. But sometimes you see that a certain part of an organization or a particular organization is starting to dysfunction, and basically, it is starting to become an entity on itself, only interested in its own procedures, and it's not helping anymore. At the moment you go to it with a problem, you come back with another problem, and so it is a kind of a pathological organism that is basically parasitic on everything that pays for it. And so I started thinking about that. And to what, how an organization with for the rest perfectly normal people can become something like that.
Yeah.
And at the same time, I was thinking about that idea. There is something like intelligence and there's something like understanding. So at a certain moment, I said, okay, maybe it is intelligence without understanding and intelligence with understanding. And I started to play with that idea. And one thing that I think that is really important is that you can, in a closed world, let's do one step back. Let's think about what intelligence actually means.
Right.
So suppose I want to measure your intelligence, then I'm going to give you all kinds of tasks. If you do really well on those tasks, then you have a very high intelligence. So basically, intelligence is measuring whether or not you are able to do mentally whatever I ask you. Yeah. So it is about mental compliance, how well you can exhibit desired behavior, mental mm-hmm. behavior.
Yeah.
Which is actually kind of a stupid type of intelligence. There is nothing creative. It's not agentic. You're just complying with whatever I ask you to. And people who might be very intelligent are sometimes completely unable to create something in the world.
Yeah.
And to behave in the world. And so there is definitely, it's not the same. So what is understanding then? Well, I would say that intelligence is for a closed world, for a small world, for someone gave you a problem and you solved the problem, but that other person knows already that it is solvable. And that all the information that you need is in the phrasement of the problem. So therefore, it's a closed problem. And for our worlds are open worlds. We wake up in the morning and we have no idea what will going to happen this day. And to live in an open world, you need something extra. And I think that is the understanding part. So when I look at an organization, and if I see that the organization is only focused on things that can be solved with intelligence, all kinds of formal procedures, all kinds of rules and regulations and things like that, but then it really doesn't need to have a clue about what it's actually doing. And so a bureaucracy then is an organization in which no one really needs to understand what they are doing, and they only have to comply and to intelligently apply the rules of the organization. And no one basically cares. There are no people anymore. It is just a formal organization. It's actually very much like a computer program.
Well, exactly. That's very interesting. I mean, as we study overall, you know, artificial intelligence, we obviously learn more about ourselves. We understand, or we have to question the part of ourselves that we don't understand to be able to create, an artificial intelligence in that way. And it's interesting, you know, to me as I was reading through your paper in the way you kind of, you know, you lay these different sections out, if you will, in terms of both the possibility of why a bureaucracy has been created, but also what kind of parameters it needs to be able to sustain itself. And to me, it's a lot about simplifying the real world to be able to control the parameters and to have, as you said, kind of have predictability within that world, correct?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So what happens if you task people with insufficient understanding of the things that they are doing with whatever task, doesn't matter what task. The first thing that they will do is basically reduce the task to something that they can do. And because they are not understanding really what they're doing, they might end up in doing a task that only superficially looks like the task that they are supposed to do. Yeah, so for example, well, in university we need all kinds of people who help students with the administration of the numbers and of their grades. And that can be a completely formal process, and typically people look at that as a formal process. But on the other hand, they are the ones who actually meet students and who see that some students have particular problems. Well, they can completely ignore that, and then you have a bureaucratic organization, or they can empathically work with that and help a student and give them some advice and all kinds of other things. And then you have a completely different organization.
Is there any other good examples you can give us in terms of bureaucracy? I mean, I certainly think about a few that have grown into immense bureaucracies, but as you were writing the paper and thinking about this, anything that comes to you?
Well, I would say that the biggest bureaucracy is a dictatorship. And a very small bureaucracy is someone who simply doesn't understand what he or she is doing. So a dictatorship is an organization. Well, it's basically, it is a bureaucracy everywhere. There are people don't count anymore. The only thing that counts is the regulations and the rules and the laws and typically all the things in the organization that say what you're not supposed to do. Yeah, instead of in a healthy situation, then you typically want to do all kinds of things. Then people are left free to decide what they are doing, and they are made responsible for the whole.
Exactly.
In the bureaucracy, typically.
Yeah.
No one is responsible anymore. The lower levels are not responsible because they only execute the rules, and the higher levels are not really responsible because, one, they don't understand the details of the lower part, and secondly, they always blame the lower parts.
Now, I want to tie this into geopolitics later as well, in terms of this, but it seems to me that, you know, it's a good point to make here that the papers becomes the ruling body, not the decisions. The rules on the paper, of course, and the people who implement these. But this is also a tendency then why the not only bureaucracies but the dictatorships turns into a fierce, you know, authoritative body, which basically becomes about disciplining, you know, the few variables within that system that are not complying to these rules. But how does this, do you think, apply to a psychological level, I guess? Because this is ultimately what drives it. Even if there's one dictator, it is, you know, his particular need or hers to be able to control the environment, correct?
Yes. And I think that is the key point. So the moment we are not feeling comfortable in any situation, we are trying to do something to feel more comfortable. And basically what we tend to do then is to control the situation in such a way that we regain a sense of adequacy in that situation. So suppose you have people who don't understand the world in which they are living. Basically, the only thing that they are doing is trying to get control over their situation. And how do you get control of your situation? Basically, by reducing the complexity of your world until the level that you actually understand it. And so I think that is the driving dynamics of both dictatorship and of bureaucracy. So we have a world that's actually kind of complex, either, well, say students or clients or whatever coming in and out, and they from the viewpoint of the real bureaucrat, they come with all kinds of irrelevant things that that the organization is not made for. Actually, it is made for that, but they not in their mind. The organization is for paper pushing and for making sure that all the rules are satisfied, etc. And
yeah.
These people come with all kinds of completely irrelevant things, that they couldn't sleep well, that their husband is ill, that whatever. And you get kind of a struggle between the people who need something from the bureaucracy and the bureaucrats themselves who see the people actually as a kind of nuisance.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Is this how most of our societies are driven now, you would say?
I'm a little bit more positive, but I would say that it is a very dominant force. And I would say that it is especially dominant at the higher levels. So not so much at the lower levels, I would say. At the higher levels, we have a much bigger problem with that we don't understand what the higher levels, I mean, the levels higher in our societal hierarchies, what they are doing. So basically, we come to that when we talk about authoritarians, libertarians. I think that's clearer if we first introduce that term.
Okay, let's go there and lay that out.
All right. Well, by chance, I read a book that is kind of technical. It is called The Authoritarian Dynamic. It's from a researcher from Princeton, Karen Stenner, and she did really wonderful research in the phenomenon of authoritarianism. And what for her, she asked people to say how children should be reared, how they should be educated until adulthood. And she asked two kinds of questions, two possibilities. So, for example, children should obey their parents, or children should be responsible for their actions. So one is rule of a compliant behavior, obeying, and the other one is being responsible for yourself. And then another question is to have good manners, or to have a good sense and sound judgment. Well, have good manners is, again, trying to behave as expected and in a socially accepted way.
Mm.
And the other one, to have good sense and sound judgment, is, again, putting the responsibility with the child, to be neat and clean, or to be interested in the how and why things happen. To be neat and clean is, well, again, comply, and to be interested in how and why things happen is actually being really interested in the world and behaving in such a way that you're actually learning quickly of that world. Having respect for elders, or to think for themselves. Well, same point again. Follow the rules and follow their own conscience. So this was a really interesting thing. And the people who scored very high on the norm compliant, they should obey parents, have good manners, be neat and clean, have respect for elders, follow the rules. People who said that was actually good for children, she called authoritarians.
Right.
And people who wanted the children to be responsible for their actions, have a good sense and sound judgment, be interested in how and why, think for themselves, follow their own conscience, she called them libertarians. And actually she did this with a long history, and so it's not just for the fun of it,
conceptualized this whole study of hers in a way.
Yes, basically, yes. And then she looked, what can I say from the people who score high on the authoritarian side or high on the libertarian side? So the authoritarian side is the norm-compliant side, and the libertarian side is the judge-for-yourself side. And she found a number of very interesting results. And it took me, I think, something like 2 or 3 years puzzling what she was actually saying. And I'm pretty sure that I get things from her data that she didn't realize herself that were actually in the data. Something she concluded really well. And then, for example, is that she concluded that authoritarians are not so much trying to avoid complex thinking, but they really hate a complex world.
Why?
And so basically what she's saying here, complex thinking, that is what you can do with intelligence. But living in a complex world, that is something for which you need understanding. So here she's basically saying the difference between intelligence and understanding. And, well, remarks like this, that really really helped me in trying to figure out what was happening here. So I started at a certain moment playing with that intelligence without understanding concept.
Yeah.
And then an authoritarian is someone who can be really smart and really intelligent, and they probably were good at school, but still they don't understand the world up to the level that a libertarian does.
Hmm.
And a libertarian feels understandable, because their parents try to educate them and about a how and a why. So when an authoritarian and libertarian walk in the same street, the authoritarian might see all kinds of things he or she doesn't really understand, while the libertarian has no problem whatsoever in the same situation. Or maybe it understands also a number of things, but it can think about a little bit and, okay, well, maybe this might be a good way of looking at it, and then the problem is settled. So the authoritarian is always a little bit on edge, walking in the same society as a libertarian who is completely relaxed in the same situation. And the authoritarian always looks around and says, oh, wow, those homosexuals, they are strange. I don't understand them. Those people with scarves on their head, that's kind of strange. Mm-hmm. Maybe should stay away from them. Well, so there's always taking distance, always being on alert, on guard. While the libertarian, they might not even see the difference because it's not relevant for them. And at a certain moment, they're sitting next to someone with a scarf, and then they are going to ask something about Islam, and they have a really neat conversation, and they don't see any real difference between them and the Muslims or whatever, while the authoritarian is still in the mode that there is kind of a strange thing going on here that he doesn't understand, and it might actually not be positive.
So, in a way, to kind of simplify that a little bit, it's about adaptability and using a set of rules, I guess, to manage to adjust to the circumstances in the real world, while on the other hand, let's say, an authoritarian kind of lacks the capability of, or they don't have those set of rules that managed to, so they can manage to adjust to the circumstances. It's much more of a rigid and kind of straightforward approach that they need to have to I guess, have a sense of comfortableness, I guess.
I think that is, that is very important. Although I think that by increasing the complexity of our societies, you can bring more people in an authoritarian mode. So it's not that you're either an authoritarian or a libertarian.
Right.
It is you're an authoritarian or a libertarian in a certain environment.
Ah, I
so
see.
So if the environment is benign for the authoritarian, he might be very relaxed and actually use all kinds of strategies that are very normal to libertarians. But the moment you stress the authoritarian, he will fall back into an authoritarian mode in which he basically is intolerant against everything he doesn't understand, or everything that is judged by authorities, typically, and we should talk about authorities as well, as undesirable. And the libertarians, they might also be confronted with something they don't understand, but they react in a completely different way. They react with interest and with a heightened sense of heightened mental faculties, and they are really, we have a problem. Okay, let's try to figure out how the problem can be solved. While the authoritarian is typically something, okay, problem, get rid of the problem. I don't want to think about it. Make sure that the problem doesn't occur.
Yeah,
and then we come typically at authorities, because who should solve this problem for the authoritarian? That is the authority. The authority is tasked by the authoritarian to solve their problems and basically to make sure that they feel adequate. And that leads to a particular definition of authorities. For me, An authority is a process or an agent that either creates, maintains, or influences a living environment. So an authority is not the state or a particular person, mm-hmm. but basically everything that maintains, creates, or influences your living environment.
Are there a couple of examples you can take?
Well, the normal thing is the state.
Right.
Yeah. So if you're not able to create an environment for yourself, you expect the state to create that environment for you.
Yeah.
Yeah. So at the current state, we have an economy that is not really functioning that well. So it is the task of the state to make sure that the economy is working again in the eyes of the authoritarian. And they will help the state in everything the state asks to make that economy work better. While the libertarian response would much more, okay, we have a problem, let's try to solve it, and I'm not going to ask the state to do that. I'm more than able to solve this problem myself without actually needing a state and making myself even more dependent on something that I can't control.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So, and there are very many authorities. Yeah. So, for example, Britney Spears or whatever is now the craze of the day is an authority for all kinds of young girls.
Right. Yeah.
Because she is defining the living environment. It's defining what they wear, what they sing, where they go out to, whatever. Yeah. And so when that authority is then going down the drain, they have a role model that is, well, that they probably follow for some time, and actually they develop themselves completely, well, down the drain as well. At least if they are not really understanding what they're doing.
Interesting. Now,
I
just wanted to ask you a little bit more in terms of as well, kind of how this developed for you along the way, because I guess all of these questions were still something that you were asking in the confines of how do I apply it to artificial intelligence, correct?
No, actually not. No.
Not really, okay, yeah.
No, but it's kind of a coalesced. I think somewhere in 2006 or so, I restarted thinking about geopolitics. I did something about geopolitics when I was studying in the mid-80s. And 9/11, I think, was very important. So I went through my phase of basically studying all the conspiracies and 9/11 and everything. And then I eventually settled on a number of alternative media channels, eventually Red Eyes as well, but James Corbett, for example, was a really useful and great resource for me. And so I started to become a little bit more competent in thinking about these kind of things, and then asking questions again. Why are people going along with everything that is happening?
Yeah.
Why don't they see the structures that I see? Why can you be fooled so easily? And that was kind of a separate issue. And at a certain moment, because you play basically with these ideas, and they start to seep into your normal body of knowledge. And I make models for perception, so I'm pretty well versed in what psychologists say about this topic, but also other topics. So then I saw more and more relations, and at a certain moment I realized that the concept of authority is actually a psychological or a cognitive science concept.
Yeah.
Because every agent is either an authority, which entails that it's able to create its own living environment, or it needs an authority, which entails that it needs other agents or processes or whatever to create its environment, and that has to do with autonomy and also with agency. Maybe you should talk something about agency, that the biological term agency. An agent is a source of behavior and of self-selected behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And living agency is an agent that is not only a sort of behavior, but it's also responsible to remain a living agent. And therefore, it should do basically two things. It should remain as far from death as possible, and it should make sure that it is in an environment in which it can thrive, ideally. And so for the agent, there are basically two ways, modes of being for the living agent. Either it must do something because it has a problem, and if it doesn't do it, it will be harmed or it will even die. Or it may do something in which it can optimize its living environment if it so chooses. So in the first case, the environment is basically controlling the agent, not in detail, but it's forcing the agent to do something. While in the other case, the agent is actually in control of its environment, and it can use the possibilities of its environment. And this is a level, I think, it's also separating the authoritarian and the libertarian.
Mm-hmm.
The authoritarian always has the feeling it needs to do things as an existential need, because it has a feeling it's much closer to the edge of viability, to things it cannot control anymore. Things spinning completely out of control, and therefore whatever may ensue. While the libertarian has the feeling that this is actually a great world, and well, sometimes things go wrong, but well, I can repair them, and actually I see all kinds of opportunities to make the world an even better place. So that is freedom for the libertarian against always being forced for the authoritarian.
Yeah. Now, what would you say if someone were listening to this and they think, all right, it sounds too simplified, that it's, okay, this is maybe something you can apply to, let's say, a system outside of the human complexity of our mind and everything else, so that this is almost like, okay, it sounds like more this is how a machine or an artificial intelligence would act, but I certainly don't do that. Are there certain parameters within human behavior that allows us to simplify it, I guess, in the way that you have done it right now?
Yes, actually, I think quite a lot. two things that come to mind. One is an evolutionary thing. We all are the result of a very long list of a long line of evolution. And evolution is typically that you build one function on top of another function, and on top of another function, etc. And it's very important that those functions on which you base other functions are rock solid, basically. Yeah, so mm-hmm. if those functions disappear or change or so, then the functions that rely on them won't work anymore.
Right.
So if you look at the brain, you see that we have a kind of in our back house, the thing called vertebrate. On the top of that, the brainstem, there are very simple nuclei and things that basically guide our breathing and swallowing and everything that we need as a very basic activity. And on top of that, there is some perception, and then there is even more perception. Some people call that the reptilian brain, and then the mammalian brain, and then the human cortex and things like that. So there's levels on top of levels. But always the functions that they rely on are kept like this. So basically, when I say that the must react to a certain situation compared to the may react, if that is something that already exists since the beginning of living agents, then it's very likely that it is coded somewhere very deep in our brainstem. So this might actually be one of the, I sometimes call it the first bit of perception. And the first bit of perception is, am I in a safe place? If you are in a safe place, then you may do whatever you like. if you're not in a safe place, you have to do something in order to ensure that you are in a safe place, mm-hmm. or you deal with the unsafety in that place. Yeah, so I think that it's exactly the same, and it still holds. We can maybe talk a little bit about later about what the cause of sound annoyance is, and it's basically this. And then the other reason is that we have higher levels of our brain at the cortex, and we have a left and a right hemisphere, and particularly the left hemisphere is involved in speech and talking.
Right.
So the inner voice that we hear, it is typically our left hemisphere talking. And the left hemisphere is doesn't have access to everything. And it might sometimes come up with a completely ludicrous idea of what the rest of the brain is feeling and doing, etc. So the stories that we tell are not necessarily true or valid or whatever. They might be, and let's hope they are, but it's not necessarily the case. So the stories that we tell us why we do things might not actually be truthful. And simply because the real reason might be so deep in our brainstem that it's inaccessible for the talking processes in our brain.
Hmm. Now, so I would want to get a little bit closer to what basically makes people to you know, what choice they make here, authoritarian or libertarian. And as you said, it's not maybe that people are this by default and then act accordingly, but it's very much dependent on the situation. Yes. But then, of course, it's something within that situation that makes them either have security or feel security or insecurity. What is that, do you think? What is it that makes that? I mean, this is something that's dependent both on our past reference points. It has to do with our perception. There's a lot of things involved in that, right?
I would say that the main thing is the level of fear in our environment. Yeah. So that determines very much whether we must or we may, whether we are authoritarian or libertarian. So basically, I think that all terrorism is a manipulation of this particular process. Yeah, so the terrorists themselves might be, well, stupid young kids or that are, well, desperate and do all kinds of horrible things. But they are brought in that situation. They are ghosts in that situation, probably by intelligence agencies and all kinds of non-state actors.
Yeah.
And they are looking for the fear. And they basically the only thing that they want to bring in society is fear, so that everyone in an authoritarian mode starts to ask their external authority to do something about that. And that makes the authority stronger, of course.
Yeah, yeah. Now, do you think that those who are behind these operations are aware of this behavioral pattern in humans?
They are smart, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. And I would say that this is probably very deep occult knowledge that I wouldn't be surprised if someone can tell me where to find it, but I never found it, but your cold is also not my strong point. No, this is definitely known.
I believe so as well. Of course, human psychology and behaviorism. There's been tons of studies on this from the Milgram experiment. You know, we've talked about this on the program.
Oh, you know, I think it is millennia old. This
exactly. Yeah, definitely.
So, but it's the interesting thing is that for the first time we now know it. I mean, the normal people.
Yeah. Yeah,
and that's so.
Well, and that can be an empowering factor in itself that actually can change this behavioral output that we've been talking about.
I think so. I hope so. Yeah.
Now, what do you make of? I mean, I've heard this for many many years now from people, you know, both within the scientific field, but also those who are not prone to, you know, believe that there are conspiracies in the world. They try to argue that the reason why people choose the conspiratorial route is because they are trying to simplify a very, very complex world. Now, I always find that kind of comment a little bit stupid in a way, because in many cases it's not about simplifying a situation. In some cases it makes it much, much more difficult, and it's really about trying to get to the root of explaining something which those who are poo-pooing conspiracies haven't taken the time to kind of to look at, if you will. But is this a question that you've heard or been battling with as well?
Yeah, well, you can make me quite aggravated if you say that I'm a conspiracy theorist. So. of course, there are conspiracies. Many people in the United States end up in jail because they conspire with someone else to do something.
That's right.
Yeah, and every judge has to think in terms of conspiracies and conspiracy theories, whether they are really there or not. And so conspiracies are everywhere. What I think is that there are basically two type of conspiracy theorists, and the authoritarian conspiracy theorist and the libertarian conspiracy theorist. The authoritarian conspiracy theorist is typically someone who knows already what has been happening. Basically, yeah, the enemy of their authority, it might be the Jews or the bankers or whatever, they are always the culprit. And so that really functions like simplifying the world. And the answer is already given. And now you look in the world for all kinds of arguments to support that answer. That is an unfortunate type of conspiracy theorist. And sometimes they are useful because they also do the work. But in many cases, I think their conclusion is more important than the evidence that they actually bring to the table.
Finding the pattern of it. Yeah.
Yes, and then you have the libertarian conspiracy theorists. I don't think that the term conspiracy theory is so good for them. They are more an intrigue theory people. What do I mean with that? A conspiracy is simply two people or more people conspiring, briefing together, making plans together.
Yeah.
But an intrigue is a very elaborate plan, and a plan that is that might be so elaborate that it is outside the range of understanding of other people. So basically, you can tell them the plan, and they won't even understand it. And so if you don't tell exactly what the goal is, but you only tell some parts of the plan, then they might not even understand what the consequences of those activities are. And the end result might be that these people are being fooled into games that they don't understand and that they will eventually always lose. So by making things really complex and by making sure that they are out of the reach of understanding of most people, you can actually have your plans completely in the open, and very few people will understand it. And who will understand it? That are the people with an open mind, who connect the dots, who do their work, and understand the world really as it is, including this particular plot or play or intrigue or conspiracy. And I think that's a completely different type of conspiracy theory. And it's a form of conspiracy theory that is very much like science.
Well, exactly. That's what's so interesting about this is you're really adding a scientific point of view to conspiracy and reality. And of course, what happens is that those people who don't take the time to analyze all the different aspects on how these things differ as you've done just jumble these things together and perceive them as one, which is another way of simplifying reality and therefore
fall into the
authoritarian view. But
yes.
Well, why don't we take a short break here in a little while here. I want to talk a little bit more about your website and some of the things that you've set up. In the second, I want to get into more of the geopolitics of this as well, cognitive geopolitical theory, as you call it. You mentioned sound annoyance and a couple other things as well that I want to bring out. But tell us a little bit about your website and some of the material that you have available there. You've basically just set it up, Jared, so tell us about it.
Yeah, well, basically, at some point, I started writing all kinds of text, basically to make sure that I had a picture clearer for myself. And that grew and grew. And at a certain moment, I thought, oh, well, maybe I should do something with this. Is a book a good idea? Well, no, actually not. Because for one, it's never finished. So I really don't know when it's suitable as a book. And then I started to think about this with a number of my students, Isla and Sibrin. And we came up with a way to write a long text with as multi-markdown text, with basically text with very little markup information, and to change that text at once into a website. And the students made a really wonderful program, Calamaro. And I started working with that program and building my website the last year. And, basically it's a kind of originally a scrapbook of ideas, and it still has something like that, but it's now more structured. So I hope it is kind of accessible for people who want to understand what the relation is between individual cognition and geopolitics, or politics in general, who want to know something about self-empowerment, what is happening to you when you develop through life, and how you can take your own development in your own hands. And then also, I think a very important thing is that there are two ways of becoming more powerful. One way is to develop yourself, and the other way is to make sure that other ones don't develop themselves or so disempower.
Right.
And actually, I think that is the thing that is happening in our world. Disempowerment everywhere. Everyone is trying to self-empower them as well as they can, in many cases not so well. Yep. And why is that happening? Because of the pervasive disempowerment everywhere. Well, and then there are some really blatant aspects of geopolitics, like making the money system so complex that only a few people understand it. Terrorism is typically another one. And then something that I think is really important is that eventually geopolitical events, they will be decided at home. They will not be decided in some Obama's office or whatever. We decide whether we want to go to war.
Yeah, that's right.
And if we don't have a choice, we will always go to war. But if we take that choice as ours, then we decide the course of the world. So I want to think about these kind of things and basically bring in all kinds of material from all kinds of good researchers from all venues and annotate them with remarks and ideas that I have on the basis of my cognitive science and hopefully end up with something that makes sense for quite a lot of people.
Well, I think it does. I mean, it's something that has very interesting potential, I think, as well. As I'm going through the website and the material and listening to this, it's a new aspect to this these particular topics, you know, that we talk about on the program, among other things, that has a, I don't know, it's something very interesting. And I've been going through the website as well, and there's a lot of interesting stuff there, and I hope that people do take the time to, you know, click in there and read through some of these things and to kind of get a different breakdown of these particular topics that they might not have heard about before. And it's something that, of course, that can be applied to many different fields, if you will. But give us the URL to the website, Jared.
Yeah, well, that is www.geopoliticsandcognition.com.
Okay, geopoliticsandcognition.com. Very good. We're going to, of course, continue to talk more about this in the second here and get into geopolitics as well. But, Jared, stay with us. We'll be right back with more. Is there anything good inside of you? Is there anything I really want? All right, that's our first hour. We're going to proceed with the second here in just a few. Don't miss our continuation here, because it gets very interesting as we start to piece together the puzzle in the second hour. We go further into authoritarians versus libertarians, and then bring it into how it applies to conspiracy and geopolitics. And this is really about cognition, human behavior and how we experience the world. And then finally, we turn back to bureaucracy to tie the bag back together. But before we continue, I just want to mention some of our upcoming guests, Timothy Good, Mark Stevens, Stephen and Evan Strong, and also Russ Baker. Follow us at redicecreations.com for much more radio, news, and everything else. You can sign up for a membership at redicemembers.com to continue to listen to our program with Chaired Andringa and also all of our previous programs. Sign up, support independent and commercial-free radio. Thank you for listening, everybody. We'll talk to you after the break.